future. Okay, thank you for coming. Well, first of all, today I've been asked to give 1.5 talks plus compete with the Blackboard seminar, so that is pretty hard. Besides, I will be talking on something very technical, that's what I've been asked to. And therefore, let me see, get it right here. Okay, you can see that. It's going to be difficult. And I don't think it interests too many of you, because it's going to be very technical, and I will not, well, I'll be very happy, actually, if you leave in time and not waste your time here. If it is something you feel that you got the gist and you don't want further details, please leave this as an informal technical discussion. All right, so I better stand over here. I can leave my synopsis to stick. So this is about single particle basis sets for realistic theories of correlated materials. And the current construction we are using in this trade, you heard Pickett's talk, also is that we derive a single particle Hilbert space from a potential, say a Kohn-Chiam potential, density functional, but any mean field potential that you can come up with is sort of what we have. And this potential, this one electron Schrödinger equation, derives or defines some Hilbert space. And out of that big Hilbert space, we are then supposed to subtract the subspace of localized orbitals for the correlated electrons. So we are typically looking at some correlated electrons which may or may not be sitting in a sea or maybe even have a common Fermi surface with some not so correlated electrons. Anyhow, this you have to extract a few degrees of freedom, otherwise we can have no hope, I believe, of doing the many-body Hamiltonian in some reasonable way. And also this separation, how we perform this separation will be important. This is where at the present stage where you put, say, a Hubbard U and on one subspace is very important how you make the separation. And you should, I'll not tell you how to do it, but I'll tell you the knobs you have, the possibilities one would have for choosing one or the other. This afternoon I will talk a little bit about special examples and show you pictures. This thing will be basically just formulas, I'm sorry. So this is about what I call third generation NGOs. You see I've become a grandfather. Here are some of the children and grandchildren listed in the sequence when they joined this project. So I was probably the first, and then as time went on, more and more people came on, and some even dropped out because I've only mentioned those who directly contributed to this technical development. And if there is one paper with Tanushree Sardas Gupta, who is here, which is just a short FISREF paper, but there are references in it, and if you go onto our homepage, there's a lot of details you can read, and there's also an 80-page long review or whatever article in a book that one can look at. So, a picture to start with. This is the kind of thing we will be talking about. A high-temperature superconductor, a simple one, a single layer, mercury, barium, copper oxide, which has just a single layer, so there are not too many spaghettis. Nevertheless, it looks pretty overwhelming. This is the LDA band structure of this material. And the band that we would be interested in, the copper X squared minus Y squared band, is this one here. And what this picture is supposed to show you in blue is that with this method I'll talk about, we can pick a bluish band. You can see it's not a Vanier state because it crosses these other states and so on and so forth. But what this is about is to pick an orbital or pick out this blue band, say. Now, that will give you some hopping intervals and some orbitals. And the Tanushi calculated this orbital here yesterday. That is the conduction band orbital with the copper and the oxygen and a little bit of halos on the other sides. And this says how much charge there is on the copper, or maybe even turn it around, on the copper side and so on. Now you might like to calculate, say, a Hubbard U, make a Hubbard Hamiltonian out of this, maybe a single band Hamiltonian, and calculate the U for this orbital. And you can, of course, calculate, or one could technically calculate the U for this bare orbital. However, it might be or might not be that you would like to screen this U with all the other stuff which you may not like to include explicit in your Hamiltonian. So this method, you can also project out, say, the valence band. So all these doing something else, you can project out those guys, which are exactly not this one, and make sure they are orthogonal to each other without great complication. And the conduction band Sanusi has done. In this method, we like to pick a certain number of orders. Well, the question is when to stop, you see, because things continues up to God in some way. And there are some barium Fs up here. And the question is whether we want to include them and how well. You see, it's not so well up here. But down here, our copper oxygen orbital band was sitting down here, so we're up here in the skies. This is just to tell you some kind. We have not used it for anything else. It just shows you the capability you can pick it. And also what you sort of course, have. If you look at this, you have to pick Hilbert space. You can never pick a complete Hilbert space, and in this case, you have to stop up here, depending on what you want to do with those states.
What's the blue and red?
The blue are the picked ones. So we picked the, some orbitals, the orbitals for the conduction band. This is only the conduction band. So we separate Hilbert space here as the valence band, the carbon oxygen band, and these bands. But these bands, since they're infinitely many, we stop at some point. And it's always when you stop, you will have some dangling orbitals or whatever sitting up here. And so it doesn't look so good here. However, you want to use this thing presumably to screen you or something like that. So this may certainly be sufficient or over sufficient. But this is just to give you an example. What it looks like. So now formalism. And I'm just going to tell you simple multiple scattering theory because that is what we are using in these methods. So just remind you about the elastic scattering from a single atom. Here's a spherical scatterer sitting here, and some plane waves comes in with some energy, some wavelength, and out goes a spherical wave. And the radial functions we're interested in here, we'll be using our nuts and bolts are, of course, the solutions of the radial Schrödinger, wave equation, say the spherical Bessel functions. So you have spherical symmetry in this case. The spherical Bessel function is the green one, which is regular at the origin, and some which is not regular, say the Neumann function, if you have positive energies, which go like here. And you have the scatterer, so you may, in this case, solve the radial Schrödinger equation inwards and out and pick the solution which is regular at the origin. This is my little phi. This is just to give you the notation. This is the starting thing here. And if you join that phi onto proper linear combination of the two independent solutions, the Bessel and the Neumann function, the coefficient here is tangent to the phase shift. That's the way you define the phase shift here. So there is a phase shift which defines the scattering or characterizes the scattering of this object here, and the phase shift then tells you how much that linear combination is phase shifted with respect to that of the regular solution, the Bessel function out here. So that's all very well known. Many years ago, 47 and so on, Coringa, Cohn, and Rostocker in 54 now use this kind of a scattering theory for the band structure of a solid, so they consider an infinite medium, and they want to solve Schrödinger's equation, infinite medium of spherical scatterers. And they write up in these terms this condition for getting a solution of Schrödinger's equation. You pick a particular energy E, maybe a particular block vector K, and you ask whether you have a solution of this energy and this K, and you write up the condition, and I will tell you what that is first here. But I will explain it in my way because that will lead on to what I'm going to say later. So I'm just going to do multiple scattering theory the way we do it now. Oops, okay, we can just have it. Okay, so the multiple scattering theory for spherical potential scatters. So in this case, we pick what I would call an orbital later on. You can call it a multiple Green function or whatever. It is an irregular solution of the wave equation. And the one we would like to pick for this solid state matter is, of course, a Hankel function, namely a function which is a linear combination of a Neumann function and a Bessel function. And then I put some powers of kappa, kappa being the square root of the energy, in such a way that this function that we want is the one which decays exponentially for negative as a function of r at negative energies, and which is an analytical function of energy in the plane defined like this. So this function defined in this way is real for negative energies, and it's an analytical function of energy. Of course, at the positive axis up here, it makes these oscillations which you saw before. But if you go away from the positive real axis, it is damped exponentially. With these definitions, you see I have now defined, this is the Hankel function here, but I've defined an epsilon comma r, which has this prefactor here. And I've defined some slightly different renormalized Neumann and Bessel functions with some prefactors, all done in such a way that for real, on the real energy axis, these beasts here, the h, the n, and the j, are real. And well, this is just so that you can think something about it. Anyhow, at positive energies, of course, the imaginary parts become the solution of the regular equation, and these ones are the irregular. All right. So this Hankel function is what will be the envelope function, you can say, of my orbitals, or you can just do scattering theory, and you know what it is. But now to put up this KKR, this Cohn-Coringa-Rostocker condition for the band structure, say the wave equation for the wave functions of this infinite system of scatterers, I define what I call a Muffinson orbital. It is not something very great in this way it's defined. I'm simply saying I pick an object which is a multipole. It's sitting on one side, say the origin, and it has a particular angular momentum, Lm. And then it has a tail, which is this Hankel function with those analytical properties I gave you up here. That is the tail of it. And inside, that is now the range of the potential on that side is S. So this is outside S, and inside the sphere, inside the range of the scatterer. It is a solution of the radial Schrödinger equation, and then I add a bit, namely this bit here, in such a way that this whole object is smooth. So that's, of course, clear, since we all know that let's say that phi plus kappa cot, that this thing here joins on to the end. So if you do it this way, and the imaginary parts is just what you see here, so the thing I attached onto here, which is imaginary, is just a thing which makes the analytical properties correct. So that's what it is. And it is maybe sometimes a little better to write it like this. You write as the phi, and then you subtract phi zero. Phi zero is simply the scattered wave seen from the outside. That's just this linear combination of Bessel and Neumann function. And then you add the Hankel function to it here. So it will be important later, but it is, of course, all fairly trivial. So the radial functions and kappa cotangent is real. Cotangent phase shift is not real for negative energies. We mostly get mega negative, but these things are real. And this bare solution, which matches on, is of course n minus kappa cot times j. And I've written in this way because then this guy here simply vanishes outside the scatterer, because this guy and that guy have the same behavior outside the scatterer, and they join smoothly on because that's the free solution, that is the Schrödinger solution, and they match to each other. So in this way, I have written it as this Hankel function, which of course diverges at the origin, plus something inside the scatter which increases quadratically, and of course in the end it's going to eat up that divergence here, this guy here. So now I'm simply taking these objects, these Muffinson orbitals, and making a linear combination of them, putting them on each side in the solid, and simply demanding that I should have a solution of Schrödinger's equation. And we'll see what comes out of that.
Well, yeah. the second way of writing this is dividing both inside and outside the sphere.
Sure. These two are identical. And the spheres, I should say here, can be overlapping, but I'll get back to that. So they're short range, but they can be overlapping. These two are identical. Maybe I should say one thing. Outside the sphere, this one equals that one. Outside the scatterer, this thing equals that. So that vanishes identically outside. This one is n minus kappa cot j. Right, that is just the phase-shifted wave. This thing is the Schrödinger solution, which becomes the phase-shifted wave outside the scatterer. So therefore, these two cancel outside the potential. And you only have that left. That's what I wrote up here. inside the scatterer. When you start going inside, just a little bit inside of S, these two join on continuously and differentiably. So this term starts to grow up quadratically as you go inside. As you go to the origin, of course, this guy is regular, but that guy has a regular and an irregular part at the end. And the irregular part is then going to eat the irregular part of this guy here, so everything is smooth and nice. I even have a picture of it, if that is a problem. So Mofington orbital sometimes is called an unstreamed kink partial wave. This is for silicon. Along the 111 direction, here's one silicon atom, here's the next one. The range of the scatter of the potential goes from here and to there. I'm sitting over this side. And the Hankel function, where hell, this is the real part here, so this would be the Neumann function in this case, is this full line, sorry. The Neumann function is this guy here. The phi, the regular solution of Schrödinger's equation is this guy up to the range of the potential. Then that's phi. Then continued backwards with the free solution, now with the flat potential. That is a scattered wave, but now taken back inside. And finally, these two at the origin in this case join up to this one, which is a Neumann function, the guy that diverges. And now if you make this one minus that one plus this one, you get the full line, which is this object.
But outside the sphere, it's just a Hankel function, right?
Yeah, sure. Everything becomes the Hankel function. So this one, the in part on that, and I, since this is a real part, it's a Neumann function. I'm drawing this picture here. But this is for positive energy.
Well, so you're
just this is positive, part. That's why, yeah. Okay. But it is a Hankel function, yes. Okay. Absolutely. Okay, so so this was just what I had here. So now I'm going to put, you can see if I put all these on the various sites, then what will is going to happen? I'm going to have all these Hankel functions inside any site, pick another site. Inside any other site, I will have the tails from all these Hankel functions, which are regular solutions, Schrödinger's equation, they come and stick in. And they, of course, have to cancel to eat up all the artificial stuff, namely all this here, because what I want in the end are these solutions of the radial Schrödinger equation, which by construction were solutions of that energy. So I simply have to have that the tails of these guys eat up all the special function stuff, the regular stuff which is sitting here. And to formulate that, you of course need just the expansion theorem. You need how to expand the Hankel function at one side in a wave equation solutions on the other side, that is at Bessel functions at the other side. So that's what I've said here in great glory detail. So for solid with sites R, the condition for solution of Schrödinger's equation at the specified energy E is that if I take the superposition now, some coefficients here, times the Hankel functions, I can just look at the Hankel functions, as I said, because they're the ones which are going to cancel out. If I project onto, these are the tails, so I sum over all sites except the R prime site. So this is now a condition for the channel R prime, L prime, L prime. Mm-hmm. So I project onto R prime, L prime, M prime on that superposition from all the other sites. And what I must have here is that this gives this coefficient, and it gives everything which was the coefficient. It, of course, gives a Bessel function, and it has to give this thing here, because then it cancels the wrong Bessel function part. Fine, and as I say, this expresses tail cancellation, and now you want to explicitly to know what is the projection, because this is the most important matrix in this whole business, is what is the projection? You have a Hankel function times a spherical harmonic sitting on side R, and you want to project this onto another side R prime, and say function L prime, L prime. And I have various notations. This is just saying that sometimes I can't write R minus R and this and that. This is also the projection at a particular distance, R here in spherical harmonics. I can write it like this. And now what is it? Since the Hankel function here is regular, its tail is regular at the other point, it only becomes the functional form is a Bessel function at the same energy. That's clear. And then there's some coefficient. And the coefficient is simply the, it is going to be the Hankel function of the difference between the two sides. And then there are some vector coupling coefficients, because I, of course, couple the L prime the L and the L prime through an L double prime. So it's a sum over the L double prime from L plus L prime to L minus L prime, the usual way. So these are just Gaunter vector coupling coefficients here. So if you put the energy equal to zero, you have the well-known expansion of 1 over I, if you like, or multipole expansion. So it is just that. So this bit here is a matrix, which we call the structure matrix, the bare structure matrix in this case, because these are the bare Hankel functions. So this is a structure matrix which can shown to be, I'll show what it is like that. And that is the essential object. That's what's known analytically. You know this stuff here, analytically, spherical harmonics and Hankel functions analytically. And this guy is the basic quantity in all of the theory, is a bare structure matrix. And that is a function of energy in real space, and you can split it up. The Hankel function had a real and imaginable Bessel and Neumann function, so it has a part which comes from the Neumann function bit of this, and I kappa and a spheric and the Bessel function. And this one is Hermitian, and that one is Hermitian, but the whole thing here is, of course, then not Hermitian because you have this over here. So S is a bare structure matrix, and if I add some, I add on-site, this is just for R, different from R prime, but if you add the on-site elements here, then you can see, well, I'll get down to that. What did I say here? For real energies, these two are real and symmetric, and the tail cancellation condition for all of this stuff, if you now use that definition of the structure matrix here, you simply get this tail cancellation condition here that the sum over all channels with these coefficients here, I'm pulling this one over on the other side, then I expand this Hankel function here at site RLM, and this guy is expanded in Bessel functions around here, and these are the expansion coefficients, what I said here, and this stuff has to cancel that stuff here. This is what, so the kappa cosecant comes in the diagonal, and the imaginary part sit out here. This thing got canceled through my definition of an on-site element here, which is equal to that. So these are the KKI equations. So we have structure constants minus kappa cosecant, which is the energy times C. This is a set of homogeneous linear equations. And you have to find the eigen, some solutions, eigenvalues here, these E's of I's, determine the zero, and you can solve the linear equations and find some eigenvectors, which you can normalize, and that is the usual KKR method. And I call this K for the KKR matrix, if you like, that structure matrix, which only depends on the structure, and now you put the phase shifts in the diagonal, and this thing is going to be the essential matrix here, is the KKR matrix.
Is it correct that S for a given epsilon depends on R minus R prime only?
No, absolutely not. Sorry. Yes. This S does. The bare one does. Sure. Okay. Sure. Bare one does.
So in practice, I can construct it for each K point.
Right. This thing has long range. It has positive energies. This thing has poles at the free electron parabola and so on because of all these wiggly tails. And you construct it in K-space, you can do Ewald summations, and then you get it K-space. That is a standard way of doing it. What I shall be doing here, the point of it, is to develop a screened theory where you have to take some other definitions of the functions, and that way this thing becomes short range and little energy dependent. So this object here, since the Bessel and the positive energies, the Neumann and Bessel functions, have long range, then you, of course, also, if you change the energy a little bit, the tails out here are going to change, and you have then a strong energy dependence. And the point is that all of this starts, the branch point is at energy zero. So below energy zero, every nice things are nice and so on. These are Hankel functions, but at positive energies, you have all these poles of these structure matrices. And this is not physical. Because in an infinite solid, the bottom of the band or whatever has nothing to do with where this muffins in zero or whatever this zero of your spherical scatterers is lying. It's lying somewhere else. So all of this is spurious, and this effort out of this is to get rid of this long range and the energy dependence. In the old days, I mean, there were people tried to say parameterize the Hasse-von Alphen measurements and so on, just by parameterizing getting these phase shifts out. But you can never fit anything with this because the Fermi energy that's going back, the wavelength is not well defined. The scatterers are so close that they're closer than the wavelength of this energy which goes into there, and therefore the energy is ill-determined, the uncertainty principle. So you want to get this thing out. And what we did in the old so-called first anarchy into this generation many years ago, 25 years ago, where I simply said, well, put this energy equal to zero, do a low energy scattering thing, put the energy equal to zero and make these scatterers overlap, and then so on and so forth. What we've achieved now is to do the same thing, but mathematically correct, not with an ansatz like putting the energy equal to zero and let the spheres fill space and stuff like that, the ASA, but do it right through screening.
Ollie, could you help me make a connection to a simpler thing? And I'm thinking of the figure that you showed just previously. The textbooks I teach out of, that I confuse students out of, discuss the Wigner-Zeitz solution for sodium, and there's this kind of pretty figure with a nice pedagogy that the atomic wave function would normally just fall off and go to zero, but no, you put it in a solid and you have this idea of the Wigner-Zeitz cell, and you force it with the boundary condition so that it should go flat there. And then it has to connect on smoothly to the next cell, and that changes the kinetic energy because del square is different.
That all came out of his own.
I was expecting that figure to that somehow have a slope that went to zero at the. So what am I missing?
I don't know. What should I say? This is KKR as of 74 or 50, whatever, 53. That's where I took off in my use sometimes to show that this Wigner-Zeitz is right. Now, what is the connection? Here you have all these poles and stuff, but nothing like what I call canonical bands. But if you, that's what I did at that time, I was just crude. I simply put the energy here to zero. Outside the spheres, not inside, outside. You just put in between the spheres, you just take low energy, say the energy is zero, then you just have the Laplace solution. Put the energy equal to zero, but also then you must blow up your spheres, take Wigner-Zeitz spheres, so that becomes space filling. And then you can see that this KKR, now I took the energy dependence out of this guy, and I still have energy dependence sitting here, these things are some other object. And I have R prime is a crystal I can block some. If it's one atom per unit cell, these just are matrices depending on L prime and L. The R minus R prime goes away, becomes a K. And then I have this, the matrix is a function of K. And in the diagonal, I have a function of energy. And you see, these are the generalized Wigner-Zeitz. That gives you what I call canonical bands, because all the matrix of this, you can see this thing gives you a bound. You have a single sphere, a boundary condition on the sphere. You pick a K that will give you a certain matrix that is anisotropic boundary condition, which if you were at the gamma point and if you take the S-like solution would give you, you have to come in flat at the gamma point. Or if you are at the Brewing zone boundary, this thing will tell you you have to come in with a node and stuff. But in detail, for each K point and each symmetry, you get this boundary, and you just have to find this potential function, as I call it, here's a function of energy. You have to match these two, and you get the band structure. That is a Wigner-Zeitz picture. But the Wigner-Zeitz picture now, historical, the Wigner-Zeitz method has this, was never popular, you see, because of what is down here. You see, the advantage of this method, despite these other things, is that it has good L convergence. Because as L goes up, the centrifugal barrier will, of course, exclude the solutions of Schrödinger's equation more and more and push them out, as you know, so the phase shift soon becomes zero. When L is bigger than 2 or 3 or whatever, the phase shift is zero. The phase shift is zero, cosine is infinite. So this matrix, the KKR matrix, just has infinite at the diagonal. And you can throw all of that stuff, all these high partial waves away. So this thing converges at L equals to 2 or 3 or something like that. And this is because the boundary, this matching tail cancellation condition has been set up in terms of a canceling of the Bessel terms. And the Bessel functions are real, considered as functions of R, expansion starting from the origin and going out. Yeah, the first bit zero, J0 is a constant and J1 is a slope and so on. So this is really setting up this cancellation in terms of the Bessel functions, and that is what gives this good, starting from the origin, give the good convergence. In Wigner and Zeitz method, what do? You get all these, solve the Schrödinger equation all the way out to the Wigner-Zeitz cell, and then you sit with great care and match the solutions out at the corners of the Wigner-Zeitz cell. In order to get the wave function accurate out there, you have to go to L equal to 14 or 15 or something like that. That's not doable. So you see, you don't let it overlap. So the great thing about this is, Here, it's a Green's function type thing. Hidden under the rock are all these free, these scatterers with zero phase shift. They, of course, contribute to the wave functions through their Bessel functions and so on, but it is excluded from the Hamiltonian or from this thing here. These are just G0, and you're just concerned with the perturbations. Whereas if you did Wigner's tides, you have to do everything, and that doesn't work.
I have one more question. The structure matrix doesn't seem to be Hermitian.
This guy is Hermitian and that guy is
Hermitian. Right, but therefore the...
This one is not, right.
Is not.
Yes.
And then the question is, basically, will this have really real roots? I mean, what kind of nonlinear eigenvalue problem we have here?
Yeah, right. That works out because the way this is written up. You can also just take, if you like, just take the thing is constructed in such a way, you see, that the imaginary part, so this part, the Bessel function, you can always add a homogeneous solution to that. Uh-huh. It works. I can say another thing. Let's say that you had an infinite solid. Then a block function, if you block symmetrize, a Bessel function is zero, except if k squared equals to the energy. Because these are both solutions of the wave equation, and they are orthogonal unless k squared, the energy of the one, is equal to E equals the energy of the other. So that's why. But if you construct it this way, it is correct also for the Green function and so on. Right. The thing I will get to is that if you define your boundary conditions different. I put this thing in a sort of have another medium of confining spheres or whatever you want. Then you push the bottom of the continuum up from zero energy here, the Muffinson zero, whatever you want to call it, and up, and you always sit at negative solutions. And in that case, all these things are real. There are no solutions of the homogeneous whatever wave equation of these energies. And that's the trick here.
Can you see what is k in the equation over there?
Sorry?
K here is k.
Square root of
V.
No, that I know.
Kappa is
kappa
C.
Kappa I know what kappa is. No, k over there. Big the last equation, big K.
Big K, this is just S plus kappa cos.
Oh,
this is definition of the KKR matrix.
Okay, great.
And this will be called the Kink matrix. It is just the definition.
It's called the KKR.
Right, this is structure. This is potential, and these things together is KKR. K is KKR. Yeah, sorry.
As part of Gabby's question, this isn't an eigenvalue equation.
It's a nonlinear eigenvalue problem.
It's
right.
It's a root finding equation.
Yeah, that's what is called a nonlinear eigenvalue problem. And the question is, does he have a solution?
Sure.
It's not obvious that it does.
Right.
you have to find sure. You have to find a vector. It's called an eigenvalue problem because the C's are like a vector.
Yeah.
And the epsilons are the things which allow for a solution.
Sure.
But for some random epsilon, that thing has no solution. So it's an eigenvalue problem. However, the epsilons enter in a highly nonlinear way. That's why it's called a nonlinear eigenvalue problem. It appears in many cases. It's not always. Solutions don't always exist. I mean,
So this was, well, I mean that it is right. It's like APW and KKR, these old first or whatever methods have this problem, and that's why I made these linear methods, because I want an eigenvalue
right.
problem. But in this case here, you can see the problem with this beast being having this kind of symmetry has to do with the fact that you are sitting often, or the energies of interest are sitting down in the continuum of the wave equation. The unperturbed system is a free, is flat potential with boundary conditions and infinity. And since you're putting yourself there, you have this branch point and you have these problems. If you can pull this thing up, this thing will be real, or it will be Hermitian. You don't get that part here, will get out.
But in principle, the physics behind it is that you also have core states at very low energies, which will actually solve that equation, because so far you've made no...
But this is on the energy shell. This method, this thing, well, you can look at it as an analytical, this thing as an analytical function of energy. But then you also, the core states, all this only concerns the wave equation. All the potentials come in here, and you of course have to ask, you may ask yourself, what is this thing for complex energy and doing that right and so on and so forth. Yes, if you want to.
In general, this has an infinite number of solutions.
Yes.
Sure. But I'm sitting, but the point of view here was doing really solving Schrödinger's equation by the Wiegnerites, but just being a little smarter about it. You pick an energy, you construct the partial waves, solve the radial Schrödinger equations here and there, and you try to see if you can stick them together in such a way that the whole thing is a smooth function. If you can, you have a solution. If you can't, you don't have any. And that's what this thing essentially expresses. Okay, now, what do I want to do? Aha, now I want to do screening. So now I want to get away from this thing and get the energy dependence and all of that away. So this is now screening. So I now define some new tail functions, if you like, some new Hankel functions. They're still, in the first place, I say, let me just call them H alpha. Alpha defines, I'll get to what alpha defines, the medium. And I'm going to make some linear combinations over all the sites of the good old-fashioned Hankel functions as I defined before, times some matrix here. So, I mean, this is now regarded as a set, a basis set, if you like, or set all the solutions at a particular energy of the wave equation with that boundary condition we had. And I make it some arbitrary linear combination of them and get some other objects here. So how do I define this? I now define my medium through phase shift. I put on all the other sites, so this guy is sitting, say, at site R and L. But at all the other sites, out of the tails, I define some phase shifts. That is a boundary condition. It's simply saying what this is a homogeneous boundary condition. It's saying what should the shape of the function or the logarithmic derivative be at all the other sites. So I simply specify a boundary condition which is not that of the that the Hankel function should be regular in all space. This guy is regular in all space except at the origin where it has multipole character. This guy is not regular in all space. It has little spikes, all these multipoles at all the sites. It's allowed to have that, but of course I put this at all the sites. But I go a little bit away from the site, let's say on a sphere or something a little bit outside, and I define that it has a certain phase shift. So this phase shift means, of course, that this linear combination, when I expand it around another site, this guy expanded around another site just gave you Bessel functions, but this guy, if I expanded another site, I say that it should have some Bessel function. I call it a J alpha, but it is a Bessel function plus a bit of a Neumann function. And this thing is a phase shift here. So I'm simply, since inside all the atoms, inside the scatterers, I'm going to do something else anyhow. I'm going to provide the proper solutions of the Schrödinger equation, not the regular solution of the wave equation, but the regular solution of the Schrödinger equation. I am allowed to do such a thing for my envelope function H alpha. So you can see in this way, of course, get a diverging function here, and that is what you could call screening. So you, it's like in electrostatics, you started out having a plus one charge here for the S function, and now you say, well, that has long range, 1 over R, but I'm going to put a quarter here, a quarter here, a quarter here, and a quarter here, or whatever, and get it screened. So I specify these guys here. And now I'm going to figure out what is this M up here. So what I'm demanding here is if I project onto this screen Hankel function, I project it onto another site or any site, R prime, L prime on this one, what it should be is equivalent to the other one. At the own site, it should be the Neumann function. But it also it has, still has R L character at its own site, a particular angular momentum character at its own site. But then there is a term which now are these J alphas times a structure matrix. This structure matrix can have on-site terms, so there can be an on-site term here. Before they didn't have an, well, they had the imaginary part, I said it had one, but then the real part didn't. So I define, I demand things should be like this. So this is just installing, saying this boundary condition on the central side, it is this. And on all other sides, it is this. And now I'm, of course, just going to stick this thing into that and then make it an equation. So what am I going to do? I'm saying, well, what is this J alpha? Well, J alpha I defined as the phase shifted wave, J minus tangent times E for L. So I'm sticking this thing, I stick this into here. And then I get this term here times the Neumann function plus this J thing gets over to the other, and I get this, you can better see it. I'm standing too deep. Why don't you just plot that in here? And then you are going to do the same thing directly on this form up here. So I'm just making this projection operator onto this. So that thing here is my unscreened Hankel function. And I know what my unscreened, the bare one was. That was just the Neumann function plus J times the bare structure matrix S. It's down here. Then times this matrix, which goes outside. And now I just compare terms. I just compare the coefficients. Of course, we equate the coefficients of the Neumann functions. Here, a Neumann function there, this thing with that thing, and this thing with that thing, times this. And what you get in the end, a matrix equation, you get that this matrix that you can express everything in terms of a screen structure matrix S alpha. And this superposition here, this M, is equal to 1 minus tangent alpha over kappa times this, and here this notation. Small letters are vectors. This is a prefactor. This is a vector just multiplying the rows of the, and this big capital things are matrices. So this is that. And the most important equation is, of course, what is the screen structure matrix in terms of the bare structure matrix and the medium and the phase shift of the medium. So this is a matrix to the first, a matrix, and this is a diagonal matrix. And this is a Dyson's equation, if you like. A Dyson's equation, which simply says how you screen this guy here. So
now, because alpha depends on R separately, S alpha is no longer a function of R minus R prime.
No, exactly. Now you see this guy here knows where the neighbors are. That takes a shape after where all the other atoms and so on. This one is also not a pure angular momentum function. Only at its own site, it has this pure angular momentum character here. At all the other sites you mix in, this guy is going to mix in other sites.
But for a periodic system, wouldn't you take alpha independent of R?
Yeah. So
then,
you don't have to, but you would.
And then still.
Well, it's periodic, yeah, if it's sure. If it's
a function of R minus R prime just as before.
Right.
Okay.
Yeah, if one atom per unit cell, but the systems we are having, you know, have 10 atoms per unit cell, and then this Bloch theorem is not very powerful because, and so the near surrounding will, but that's right,
right.
Sure. Sure.
Right.
Sure.
No, but I'm confused
right.
about
it.
You're right, you're right, yeah.
If we take a system with, say, 2 atoms per unit cell,
right.
then what does that mean? S alpha now becomes a function of K and.
And the two sides in the cell, yes.
Yes, that's it.
Sure. The indices, the R indices only run over the sides inside the first cell.
Right.
Sure. 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 So it is true that the cell that you translated, the alphas have to, if you're sensible, you will, of course, choose alpha to apply to the space group symmetry, to the identity representation of the space group.
So there's a little problem with notation that R was meant to indicate both the position inside the unit cell.
Yeah.
And
that is my, that's a great invention. Sorry, I couldn't take it. You see, I sometime in my life, I gave up writing everything up in this way and in that way. So I'm in real space. And if you know that there's a Bloch symmetry, you go and Bloch symmetrize it if you want to. But you could also do it for a cluster.
Okay, I understand.
Right. So this, sorry, that's a notation. Yeah.
It's true, it's often confusing.
Yeah, but it is just very cumbersome. If you only do this kind of math, you know, you sort of make some simplifying conventions. So I'm not. You should always think, I write it up in real space, but there are, if you have translational symmetry, there are simplifications, namely that you can block some of the thing, and then the R only runs over this, the atoms in the cell.
Which, by the way, is nice. It's nice because if you also you put the internal phase factors. If you have several atoms per unit cell, you also multiply by the e to the ik times the distance of,
yeah,
which is the correct way of doing it.
Okay, so this is the basic operation in the whole program. So you generate this is to do this equation here. So I write it a little different. You don't invert because it has poles and so on. So you write this equation like this. So this is this Dyson's equation, yes. So the bare structure, this is the KKR, well, except that here you put the medium and not the real phase shift. So it is S plus kappa cotangent, that matrix you want to invert. And that is the business you have to do. And then, well, you multiply it from the left and the right with this and that, and then you get the S alpha. Since S alpha, now if you choose your alphas properly, I'll get to how you choose the alphas, but for a proper choice of alphas, this thing becomes, as I said, localized, fairly localized, exponentially screened. And in that case, you can generate this thing in real space, although this guy has infinite range. You can do this and that for a finite cluster and invert it for a finite cluster, and you don't have to use the Ewald method if you were solid to do that, and you can do it. I'll get to that. I say, if you have 100 atoms per unit, if the range, you can easily get to a situation where the range of this one is smaller than the unit cell. And then, of course, it's much faster to do this inversion in real space and then block some, instead of first do the Ewald method. In the Ewald method, you have to block some of these long-range animals. That's why you have to use Ewald instead of doing this stuff here. Now let's look at this guy. So now this screen Hankel function, we know what the properties were of the bare one. So the screen function is a solution for the following inhomogeneous boundary condition, namely that, as I said, it is the Neumann function in the eigen channel, and it is proportional to these J alphas, these tail functions, if you like, in all other channels. Right, that was the boundary condition here. So I'm saying at the own side, it has pure angular, it has the divergence of it, has pure, the pole has pure L symmetry. But outside, on all the other sides, and also the same side, another one, it's going to have some particular logarithmic derivative or some particular phase shift.
Why did you switch from Hankel to Neumann before?
Because the Bessel Z'd up. The diverging part is the Neumann function. Or the irregular part of the Hankel and the Neumann function are identical. Because the difference between a Neumann function and a Hankel function is a Bessel function, and a Bessel function is irregular.
Right.
And that one is real for real integers. The Hankel function is not real for real integers. Not the normal Hankel function. Okay, and it is the homogeneous solution, well, here. Now, the imaginary part of this guy is a solution for the homogeneous boundary condition. Yes, the imaginary part is just all these J alphas. And since that is, so if I now have some energies which lie outside the energies, the eigensolutions of my medium defined by these alphas, if I can adjust the alphas in such a way that my energies of interest are in gaps or outside as a solution of this one, then the imaginary part will vanish because there are no solutions of the homogeneous of the medium. And if you look at these things, that means also this guy will be real now. And that's back to your question. In this case, the imaginary part is zero for all energies. And those are the energies for which this guy is localized. So you can adjust your medium in such a way that these guys are localized, that the energies are outside the eigensolutions of the medium, and then these guys are localized and they're weakly energy dependent, and then we can get the screen structure matrix, as I said, that will be the thing in real space. But the thing is now how to choose the alphas, let's say. So you do this. So you now have these knobs on all the sides, these alphas, this medium, and you can adjust that according to various things, wishes that you might like to have. Okay, you can make this transformation. I said this m alpha on the KKI equations, and then they just look like this. These are the screen KKI equations. Now you have a matrix with just a screen KKR stock matrix, which we generated up here. And in the diagonal, it has Kappa and cotangents to some phase shift, but these phase shifts are now the phase shift seen on the background of this medium. So the relation between the phase shift, the eta sub alpha, is of course the real phase tangent of the real phase shift minus tangent of the medium. So if particularly you had chosen this guy equal to that guy, the medium equal to the real scattering, then that's called downfolding. We will get to that. And then this guy goes to infinity, and you can forget about that block of the KKR matrix. So the phase shifts are now seen on the background of those chosen medium phase shifts here, and otherwise everything looks the same. And this is called K alpha. This is the screen KKR matrix. So this is basic quantity. So in the calculation, you start by this bare one, which you know analytically, then you invert it and get the screened ones, and then you can add this one, the diagonal. You can now do Green's functions and things with it. So Now, I have not defined the Muffinson orbital, the screened MTO, yet. I just made that transformation on the KKI equations, but if I'd like to see what the waveform, the orbitals are like, let me now do it here. So I do screened MTOs, and now, as you know, your babies, if you love them, they have many different names. I don't know what it's called. So I'm just saying that the screened MTOs is something I will call, or I can define them. I'll tell you why. They're called kink partial waves, like APWs. Or they're NMTOs with N equal to zero, so it's the lowest generation of NMTOs. You will get to all of it. Now I'm writing up what the screened Muffinson orbital sitting outside RL prime. And it can be written, this is not a proof, you can go through it yourself. It of course has a tail, I'm rewriting it in the other way where we had it before, where I take the screened Hankel function, is added to it. This is the overall function, that's the envelope. But inside the scatterer, it has a phi minus a phi zero, zero being the solution of the wave equation, and then times a spherical harmonic. This object, remember, was not a pure L spherical harmonic. It has L character on its own side, R, but outside it has all these little halos of the other thing. This thing is limited to inside the cell. It goes to zero inside the scatterer at R prime, L prime, and has pure angular momentum character. It's a spherical harmonic. That's why I like to write it. Okay, so this was a postulate. Now you can project onto the various channels and make sure that this is what it is. Now, I would not allow to make a particular choice of this medium. And I would also like to redefine, renormalize these guys. You see, these guys have all these divergences sitting at various parts because the Hankel function is now looking like this, and the screened one has all these irregular solutions on all the sides, and you don't want, they of course cancel out the solution, but this object just written like the way we had it before is of course a crazy thing because this thing has all these divergences, and on the own side it's fine, but it has all this stuff here, we want to cut that away, which you can easily do. So that's what I'm now going to do, and it's not an approximation because it gives the same solution. So I would partition the channels into what I call active and passive channels. And now for the active, for RL belonging to the active channels, I'm going to choose my medium in such a way, the alphas in such a way that this tail function, the JL of alpha is equal to zero at a particular sphere here. So I simply choose for the active channels, that's where I'm going to put orbitals in the end. That is the cover x squared minus y squared. That's your thing. And for that thing, I'm choosing a Hartsfield boundary condition, basically. So I'm just defining that this phase-shifted wave here at some chosen radius here is equal to zero. And then I'm going to substitute inside such a channel that was, of course, this divergence, this thing going like that. And I'm going to cut this function off. It goes to zero now, so it's a function coming in, going to zero at that sphere, and then it diverges when you go close to the nucleus. That thing inside the sphere, I'm going to cut out and put it equal to zero. So the function now goes like this, then it has to become zero with a kink. So outside it goes here. I'll show a picture close to that. So it has a kink in the active channels. This, and that's why I call it a kink partial wave. In the active channels, it has a kink, but not at this continuity. For the passive channels, I'm simply going to choose the medium equal to the proper phase shift. So I'm adjusting the shape of this Hankel function such that the tails in some of the channels just match onto the regular Schrödinger equation solutions, because that's the ones you must have. So I'm choosing this thing equal to that. And then I'm going to substitute now, instead of having this Neumann function plus tangent 2 alpha times the Bessel function inside here or whatever it was, I'm going to just put in the proper regular Schrödinger solution with the coefficient such that it matches. And this thing now matches continuous differentiably because I have chosen this one to have the proper phase shift. Therefore, in the passive channels, I have the solutions of the proper Schrödinger equation, radial Schrödinger equation, and the augmentation, this thing is smooth.
Before you made the choice of the alphas, these wave functions, the MTOs were smooth, right?
No, but it has all these divergences, yeah. It's always smooth. It's always smooth, but has divergences. So what I'm doing, right, I'm setting, I don't like the divergences, I make kinks instead. So instead of having divergences at the origin, I just make kinks at some chosen non-overlapping hard spheres here. That's all.
Can you explain how you, a little bit more how you do that? I mean, when you say you substitute and you choose the alpha, what precisely do you mean?
Right. So I'm having some sight over here, and the tail of this thing comes and sticks in. And I'm demanding that this tail is a certain linear combination of it is of this thing. So this is this J alpha, and this J alpha is defined as something like the J, which is regular,
right,
minus and then tangent whatever to this alpha times the Neumann function, which is irregular. And now I define that a certain radius A, that I want to have a node. I specify a node in this function. Right. So in the old guy, in this stuff up here, the function at another site has this divergence looking like that. Now I'm saying, and of course at the solution of the KKI equations, all these divergences cancel out. But to have an orbital, if I want to have this orbital picture and I want to have this guy here, it's not so nice. It doesn't look good on your pictures to have this thing, and I'll get back. Well, there are deeper reasons for it also. So I'm not going to have that. I'm going to substitute this guy. I'm going to take this away, and I'm going to do that. Now I get a kink here.
Right.
Okay. That is what this thing says. And also on the own side, there's a similar thing. At the own side, that it goes up as n, but then there's always an on-site term of the screen structure matrix, so it also has some J alpha contribution to it, which so on the own side you will also have a kink because of this thing. Yeah.
So on the own side you also have some divergence on the own side that you cure.
That right, because that's right. On the own side, you see, that's what we had before. Mm-hmm. I have the picture here. Let's get this back. So on the up, at the top, we have the picture I had before for the bare one. And remember that as you go through here, this guy cancels that guy, so you get the black guy. Right? Now with this new definition here, now a screened one, it's all silicon P, sorry for silicon, but broadbands, so in this case I have the following. So I solve the radial. Oh, it's difficult to see everything here. Oh, so the solution of the radial Schrödinger equation at the chosen energy is this guy here. That is the same in both pictures. It is this guy here. That is the dot dashed curve, and it's called phi. That thing is the same. Now, the backward solution, the free solution, the phi zero, which matches onto this one, and it's just over the flat potential going back, it is also the same. What is not the same are these called psi. These are the screened Hankel functions called psi here. The screened Hankel function in this way here, the real part of it, sorry, was the n function, which is that guy here. And the matching of these two things is something which happens in this, well, can't tell here. In this case, it is a screened Hankel function, which is this function here. And that function diverges at the origin and at the next site. So here's one silicon, here's the next silicon. If I get over to the next silicon, it's going to diverge here, and then it's going to come up again, and so on, it's diverge. What I do is I cut the divergences off. I choose some spheres A. This is the sphere A sitting here, putting some other A sphere on this one, since the silicons are equivalent, I choose the same A sphere on the two sides. And then I'm going to continue only that screen Hankel function back to this point, where it is then joined onto the other guy, but with a kink. There is a kink in this stuff here. I can, of course, only match the amplitudes. And similarly, on this side over here, I've cut this thing out, but I match it with this other one, and it looks like that. And then you can say, well, why didn't it go to zero, as I showed in my picture here, but there's a little something sitting in here. This little something are the downfolded channels. There are some passive waves, the Fs or whatever, which sit here and they make this stuff. So you remember, this thing is channel by channel, and if you make a three-dimensional picture of it, it sometimes looks differently. Is that okay? So, as I said, we choose, so which you could also say, so the screen Hankel functions are, of course, superpositions of bare ones, but you could also look at them as solutions of the wave equation with certain boundary conditions, which you install, say that on its own sphere, if it's sitting here, it has a pure angular momentum in the old channel, and it becomes zero and all these other spheres. But these are only chosen channels. It doesn't become zero in that sphere. It's only for the active waves that it becomes zero. If I choose all waves to be active, then it does become zero. But that's not what you want, because then you're going to lose your good angular momentum convergence. Remember, because of the centrifugal potential, as L is bigger than 2 or 3, the phase shift is zero. So you should make sure not to choose this medium in such a way that you don't have zero phase shifts at high L's, because otherwise you're going to lose this good convergence. So you, so these spheres are not that high. Okay, now. Hi, Mike. Welcome. All right, so what are we saying now? So, okay, I came to this point. Channels are chosen. So the A channels, the active channels, are chosen, I said, with these hard spheres to give localization by means of confining or hard spheres. So you see, the thing which will now, if I have many active channels, my thing will, the way of understanding localization, you could say, is to confine the solution of the wave equation through those spheres. And the less active channels I have, the more delocalized the thing gets. Okay, and as I said, upon renormalization and the substitution of these functions I talked about, then this K is going to be a kinked mate. Now I'm going to have a different interpretation of the KKI equations in terms of these kinked partial waves. And what the, okay, it's coming. And as I said, the P channels, okay, the passive channels now only contribute to tails. The passive channels are smooth, and I'm not going to keep basis functions for the passive channels because they were already smooth. Okay, so the passive channels contribute to the Muffington orbital tails, and they are deleted from the screen KKI equations. That's clear because in the KKI equations in the diagonal, you have kappa cotangents of eta A, and if that thing is the same as the medium, then the phase shift is zero, the relative phase shift is zero, and then you just get infinity. So you don't see them there. Okay, and what do the screen KKI equations in this language of kinked partial waves say? It simply says that you make a superposition of the active kinked partial waves and you demand that all the kinks cancel. You get those things here. So that is now shown on this picture here again, just illustrated. So this is now this object. So we have this kink matrix, the KKR matrix, now renormalized a little bit. And then the object for silicon, so here is a screen, so here is the regular solution of the wave equation, that the one continued backwards up to this point, it's matched onto that screen Hankel function, which is this violet thing. The screen Hankel also has a bit inside here, but only the passive channels, the L channels, and then it has a kink here. Now the real function is this one minus that one plus this one, it'll have a kink here, and the tail also have kinks here. So if you look at the blow up, let's see, I look at the kink up here. This is just an interpretation how these KKI equations look like. So what the kink is, of course, I'm trying to say that the kink matrix expresses the kink. It is a matrix and it has a kink partial wave sitting here, and over in the channel over there, there's a certain kink, and that is the value of this kink matrix. So the kink matrix, the kink of the whole thing is this. I said this thing is this one minus that, and it is of course composed of the kink of the Hankel function, the screen Hankel function. Then it has something in the diagonal that's a real logarithmic derivative. That is, so instead of having cotangent of the phase shift of the diagonal, you now have the logarithmic derivative, and you just have the kinks of this one and the difference between these ones and that. Okay, and if you now solve the KKI equation, now you put all these objects on the various sides, and then you demand that the kinks and these tails are going to answer the other ones here. And what's going to happen is, of course, that the thing is going to look like this. So this backward-forward thing, which is the thing which allows me to do overlapping potentials and so on, you can see that these things cancel out. Now, if the kinks, because the two solutions you had up here, remember, in that channel, this one and that one are both solutions of the same radial wave equation, but they have different boundary conditions because this one comes from here and the other one comes from something else. But when you have solved them, they also have the same boundary condition, and that means they're identical, so all of this stuff vanishes if you just get that.
Okay. Then you have to solve this equation, right? You have to solve the
KKI equation. Yeah, I'm not going to do that, but that's what NM2 does. That's another day. Yeah, I'm still just multiple scattering theory, but I'm trying now to going slowly and convincing you about this thing of looking at it like APWs or kink matrices that had great advantages, as you will now see. So let me say a little bit shortly something about that. Boop. Why? It's not quite the same here. There. Okay. Since this kink matrix gives the kinks of the set of these kink partial waves, now I omit these R's and L's down here. I look at this as a set, and this is a row vector of the basis functions. And this is a matrix. Well, here I have it. So let me say that. These are the kinks. Now, if I operate with my one electron Hamiltonian minus the energy on this such a kink partial wave, then it was constructed to be a solution. Remember, the passive channels were solutions of the Schrödinger equation. And everywhere else it was also a solution because it's a wave equation in the interstitial region and so on and so forth. So you're only going to pick something up from the kinks, and the kinks, so you're going to get a delta function because you have grad squared sitting on this inside here. All the potential things have gotten out because I have solutions, so I'm going to get a delta function on the spheres. And all the active, so R's and L's runs over the active side. So I get a delta function on the active side and the angular momentum character with these because I projected into channels. And the size of the kink is given by the kink matrix here. So you see, this is another way. I told you the geometrical way of understanding the kink matrix or the phase shift way of understanding the kink matrix. Here I show you sort of a Hamiltonian way of understanding what this kink matrix is. So this ring works on that here. Now, we define a green matrix, which is the resolvent or whatever, with the scattering path, or I don't know what Joffe calls it, but it's k to the minus first, anyhow. So G is k to the minus first. If I now invert this equation here formally, I simply multiply by G or k to the minus first from the right of this one, I get another object. So I multiply by this thing here, then I get a delta function on the right-hand side, I project this out, and here I get phi times G, and the Hamiltonian operating on this thing is a delta function in a certain channel. This thing I will call a contracted green function because it is. This is a contraction onto the hard spheres and channels of the Green's function, because remember the old usual definition of a Green's function here, G of V of R and R prime is a delta function R minus R prime when I operate with the Hamiltonian. This object here has the property. So what I have done is I've taken the R prime and confined it to a hard sphere and expanded in spherical harmonics. Then this delta function is become that stuff here. So therefore, phi times G, and that's what you can see here, is called a contracted Green's function. Phi times G, where this thing only runs over the active channels, is a contracted Green function that'll have some importance in what I say later. The geometrical interpretation of this thing, if you think about these terms, is that this guy only has a kink on the own side. It's smooth in all channels, except the old, because that is what this thing says when I operate with the Hamiltonian. Only this thing is sitting on side RL has RL. It's sitting on RL. When I operate with the Hamiltonian only, I just get a delta function on the own side. So it only has a kink at its own side, and it's smooth throughout only at the own thing. It has a kink, and it has poles, of course, at the solutions of the Schrödinger equation, because it is times this G which sits here. So it is a kind of a kink function. Right. Okay, now, finally we're coming to what we all, Sasha, has been waiting for, up and down folding. Ups and downs, yes, all right. So I'm now again going to confine my choice or restrict my choice of a medium. Well, one thing is that if I had these, I could, of course, have transformations, alpha to beta transformations, where the radius of the sphere changes and so on. But you see, but the way I've chosen the King partial wave, I have to keep my spheres constantly. If I choose not to do so, I'll get a different basis set, because the function, some function which has kinks at these sites, and you then change the sphere radius and it gets the kinks on the other, that is changing your basis. So let me now confine myself. I want what I'm doing now with up down fully, I'm gonna, you know, so I'm saying in order that the MCOs transform linearly among each other upon downfolding of such transformations, I will keep the radii constant. The radii only depends on the sides. And they are some, and they cannot be overlapping, as you can easily convince yourself. And they are something like ionic radii. I mean, they are physical or chemical choices, because these radii in the end define this freedom, defines to some extent the shape of the orbitals, because it adjusts where are the nodes of these things. So I keep the A's the same, but what I'm going to choose is I'm going to choose different degrees of passiveness in those. So what I'm saying is, so in the following, B refers to a complete representation, or I should say I've now changed from alpha to beta. When I'm in this, when I'm in not in the phase shift language, have alphas and betas to do the representation. Here are these kink partial waves, and this thing has A's and B's and so on. I'm sorry, just to give, this is just a renormalization of things. But so the B representation refers to a complete representation, let's say with active channels in a set capital B, including all the atoms and all the L's up to 3. So that is the usual ASA standard, everything, SPD and all the spheres, and God knows whatever you have. So that is sort of a complete set. And that's where you want the wave functions. You have all these radial waves, whereas A refers to a downfolded representation with just with active channels A, which are just a subset of B. So B is the big one, and A is a small one, and the difference are what I call the intermediate channels I. Okay, now I go back to my contract. It's easy, that there are primitive way of doing it. We took too many view graphs, so let me use these contracted functions here. So from that definition, the two contracted green functions, the gamma A and the gamma B, are identical because they both had kink one on their own sphere and nothing, and were smooth in all the other channels and diverge as a function of E at D. So these two, as you, well, there are further things, but these two are identical, except for the fact that in the gamma A, that's what it say here, but the functions with the channel, these functions corresponding to this intermediate set, they do not, they only exist in the B set, not in the A set. So what I'm trying to say, and this is what downfolding means, you see, you have these two Hilbert spaces, and the basis functions or these things are the same for that part, namely A, where the two sets have equal size, but the extra ones you have more in B, there are no equivalents in the A. All right, so what you should need, so what I'm saying, so here is the green, so this is phi A, GA, this is the set of a contracted green functions, and that only goes over the set A, as I said. That thing you can, of course, expand. Now I'm going to do this downfolding business. I can expand that, and it should be equal to the phi B. So I'm going to expand it to the B set, and here's, of course, phi B, E. I sum over the AA channels, and I sum over the I, because I have phi B of the intermediate to this wing. So I'm going to have A. I'm only going to look at the A component of this contracted B function, but if I write it up in this set, which is the set you know, remember, take copper, oxygen, take a high TC, then the A set would only be one orbital, the copper x squared minus y squared. But the B set, of course, has the oxygen character and the lanthanum character and this and that and whatever. And when you want to look at this orbital in detail, you, of course, want to know what, to expand it, it's not enough to say that it's copper x squared minus y squared, it has all these little tails and this and that and whatever, so you want to represent it in something, and that is this B space. Okay, so what do we do now to get this thing? I'm going to kind of get something, I'm just getting the downfolding equation. I don't know whether that convinces you. Sasha has some other notes I gave him which does it in another way. So anyhow, now I want to see what these guys are, I want to get us some downfolding equations. So I just partition in the usual, I take the B set and I, of course, partition it into an A and an I, and I do the usual stuff. I say it's well known to everybody. And what I'm going to find, So what I want to do, maybe I said, didn't say it clear enough. I want to cause a relation between the phis. I know that, but I want the green function. I want to know what is this guy and what is that guy in terms of the functions we know, namely the structure matrix in the B and in the A representation. That's the guys we calculate. Okay, so the usual downfolding gives GB, and the AA part of it is the usual downfolding thing, and that's the guy you calculate, and you, of course, invert its high block, and you do the usual stuff. And this is the off-diagonal here. If you now do the same thing for the A set, this was for the B downfolding, the B here, the A equations, the green for defined definition of the B and the A thing had the thing that this part, the II block, the phase shifts were, the cosinus were infinite. So that was the way this thing was defined, that I had passive waves. The intermediate ones were passive. I had chosen them to be. So in the carbon oxygen orbital, I choose the phase shifts of the oxygens. I choose my medium such that the phase shifts of the oxygens are the right ones now. So we have infinitely here, of course, but it gets to be that. And that means that for the green function, the blocks of the green function in A representation, all the off diagonal at zero. And the AA block of it is equal to KAA to the minus first, and that is a whole green function, as you all know better than I do. And now I stick this thing into my equation here for this contracted green function. So I have the contracted green function in the A space with phi A times GA, but GA is nothing but the inverted KKR matrix in the A representation. That's what this thing says up here. Now this was equal to phi B. It was phi B times GBAA. The GBAA, that is the downfolder stuff, which we know so well. GBAA is this thing here. And then it was plus phi for the intermediate waves here. And the intermediate wave should be multiplied by this green function. And that green function, of course, has this guy here, which I can take outside the parentheses and put it over here. So what does this equation now tell me? It tells you, first of all, that the function inside the square parenthesis, this is a function including the low or the A channels and the intermediate channels, that function is equal to the downfold. So this gives you the downfolding of this thing here, or the upfolding if you want to go from this one to that one. This tells you what you're supposed to do. This object here is smooth in all the I channels. You can convince yourself of that again. So that gives the upfolding of this complicated compound orbital, if you like, into its component. This equation here, this thing equals to that thing, we all know that, that gives the usual downfolding. That's what you start to know, because you start to know K beta, you start to know this guy. I'll say it here, and you want to get that guy. So this equation is maybe an over-smart way of doing it, but it's having the up and downfolding thing. So this equation yields the upfolding of phi A, that's what I say, that this guy folds up to the big set B, and the downfolding of this one. So let me say that again. Since B is now, I'm going to say what we're doing. B is a strongly screened type binding representation, I call it. So we start the calculation by starting in the B, S, P, and D, or whatever on all the bases set. And we start by generating the structure constants in real space through inversion of the bare structure constant plus this thing here in that language. In the B block, in the big show, invert, and this thing you can invert on a cluster, on a real space cluster, that's localized. Once you have that thing, then you, if you had a crystal, then you can block sum it to this object here. And you want to do that because later when you want to downfold, the it could be that the orbital expands and expands. You have no control over the range of it, so you'd like to do it in K space, unless you know what it is, how big the range is. So you do that. Okay, you block something to this, and you add kappa cotangent in the B to the diagonal, and then you get the kink matrix in the beta representation. Now you want to downfold this to Ka. Downfolding to Ka tells you what it is, that this Ka equals to this green matrix, which is given by the usual downfolding formula, which you have up here. So that's normal downfolding, but this is downfolding on the energy shell so far. Downfall into Ka, okay, fine. After you then find, so okay, so you start by now getting down to Ka. Now Ka is a small matrix. You now use NMTO or KKR or something to solve the eigenvalue problem or green function or whatever you're going to do. After you found your results, you want to blow up again because you want to know what the wave functions were. And that you then want to blow up, and that was using this other equation I had up here. So you want to blow up and continuous in the A representation, and you can use NMTO, which I'll be getting to maybe some other day, I don't know. And you want to upfold the wave function, the charge density in the green function using this expression for phi A. I'm just tossing at you. We have to stop in 10 minutes, I think, at least. How do the green matrix transform? I told you before how the structure matrix transforms, and out of that, and you also know how the phase shift transforms, simply that the tangent in the screen representation is tangent minus tangent, and this, that. Then you can, of course, work out how the K and the KKR matrix of the green matrix. What it turns out to be the case is this, that G in the screen alpha representation is expressed in terms of the bare green matrix with this. And what this says is simply these are no matrix operation. This is a matrix and that is a matrix. This is a vector just multiplies the rows. This is a vector just multiplies the columns. And this is just adding something in the diagonal. So the green matrices transform very simply. You could also say I want to rescreen. I want to go from beta to alpha. That's what we had before. And the so-called scaling relation for the green matrix is simply, again, this. You just multiply rows and columns and add something in the diagonal. This may, however, not, if you go, it looks great, and we just do, because all we need for this are really the G matrices. But it is a little, if you're in K-space, it's fine, but otherwise you have to be a little, worry a little bit about which are, these are infinite matrices and stuff and things like that, yeah.
Are there cases where those scaling operations which are fine formally are ill-defined or dangerous numerically?
I don't have that much experience with it. You ask Joseph. I don't know. I mean, when I use these things, I mean, I usually only do it for real energy since I'm a band structure man. But if you use them properly, one to do that. But I haven't heard of any problems with them. But I must see, we don't really use them as much. Sometimes, you know, I think maybe there's a neat solution by using that. But the guys who use are the CPA guys like Joseph. What am I going to show? I am going to show examples of this downfolding business, just trivial things. So this was again back to silicon. You've seen it many times. So this was the silicon kink partial wave, let's say, for an SPD set. So in this case, I have chosen S, P, and D as active, and only the F and the Gs and the Hs are the passive ones. And that's why this P orbital looks like this, and that you have this little stuff inside here. These are the F waves. And here, this little bit of stuff you have inside here are the Fs. Now, I don't want S, P, and D on silicon. Pauling told us I can get away with doing S and P. So let's get rid of this D. And that's what happened here. If I'm going to get rid of the D channel, and now, so this would be the A representation, if you like. Now, this would be the B representation, the big one. Now, this is the A where I've got rid of the D. I just want an SP set. Then if you want to get rid of the D, you see you have to put the D in the tail. That's what happens over here. So all in the neighboring side, that's where the D now applies. So the orbital, the kink partial wave, where the Ds are now passive and now active, is now going to look like that. But it's there and it works. And there's a picture here, the SPD set. That's the bands, it doesn't matter so much. This is the NMTO, I haven't talked about that. But I'm going to show the kink partial waves for the SPD set at this energy, that energy, and that energy compared to the band structure. The band structure calculated with this thing. So this is now P orbital. This is at the lowest energy. Don't look at that. This is a silicon atom, and the neighbor is sitting over here. And you can see this is this P sticking from this guy to that, P111. You can see there's a kink in it at its own side. You can sort of imagine there's this kink. And you can also see there's a hard sphere here because I demanded that the S and P and D components over on that thing here vanish. That's why it doesn't go there. It's confined. It doesn't really go into this side. If I increase the energy and go up, then it becomes more diffuse. As you can see now, silicon is not a narrow energy thing. This is a 10-volt range, which I go over, so the orbits change. on this side, and then, you know, but you still see the hole here. If I go an even higher energy up at the gap, it goes here, but you can see there's this hole here. Now I downfold the D's, I don't want the D's, and then this picture changes to the following. Well, maybe I should also say, since I'm not getting to it today, this morning, I can see, here's the NM2, that is the basis that you'll eventually use. It's some linear combination of those guys, but I will not get to the details, I'm afraid. But, and that is the one used to calculate the bands. Okay, now I just take the SP set. So now my basis set has become smaller, just 4 orbitals per side. And now you can see over here the same energies. Now I have D character at this side, of course, as I must have. And this higher, I have D character here, and this, you know, this thing gets even more delocalized than the other one, and the orbital it solves, it looks as complicated as this. But it does the bands right, and if you were looking at it, and this is the conduction, the valence, but you cannot see the difference before you get way up in this. And you can even be more crazy with this method just to show how it works. Let's say, well, I only want the valence band, I only want 4 bands, since I have 2 atoms per cell. I just want 4 bands. How can I do that? Well, I'll do it in the worst possible way. I will down just put orbitals on one of the silicon sites. On every second silicon, I'll put my S&P orbital, and every second I will not put any. That's corresponding to an extreme ionic picture. It's silicon 4 plus, silicon 4 minus, if you like. But this construction has the advantage it doesn't matter whether silicon is in the diamond structure, something else, or whatever. It could even be a metal, but we'll get it back to this. So now I downfold everything sitting over on this side here, and that's why you can see it is now sticking into here. And it gets a little bit more diffuse as you had it before, in particular at this higher energy. Well, if it's even a little lower, you only want this band. It's this, but you might make this linear combination, which I'm not telling you about, right? This NM0 with this 2. And the bands, we now choose these energies you get, is this. Great, I just directly downfold it, and what you can prove is that as you now increase this measure just to 3 energies, but in this case, if you take more and more of these, you just converge the Wannier function or space, which spans the Wannier thing. And that Tanusha has shown by now taking this object and now symmetrizing. You know, this is, of course, a basis set where you have 4 orbitals which don't look the same, but if you have the diamond structure, you can, of course, symmetrize them so they look the same. So you simply make SP3 hybrids sticking along the EV over this. I'll do that in stages. First, this is the S orbital of this, and you can see the S orbital on that silicon, of course, spills out to those sites where I want it to be. So this is the compound. I only put the S orbital here, but it, of course, has to cover those 2 also here. So that looks crazy, and that is the P orbital, which I put here. It, of course, has P symmetry like this, but it, of course, spills out to these other things that it should. But if out of those you now orthogonalize, you can do that with Lefim symmetrical orthogonalization, and form these guys here. The SP3 directed orbital for this is the bond orbital, as pictures, as you know. Sasha will talk about such things this afternoon. This bond orbital should have had a mirror plane here. It doesn't quite. And why doesn't it? Because I only took 3 energy points. But if you take a finer energy mesh, then it's going to be the right thing. Okay. Now, I think we have the lunch seminar in 3/4 of an hour. What I wanted to get to this, but this is going to be another day or never. So far I only told you scattering theory, I'm sorry, or KKR, screen KKR theory. But out of this, the idea is now out of these kink, you can see these kink partial waves, say for silicon or broadband thing, not necessarily for carboxide or like that, do change, have a quite an energy change as you go from the top of the band to the bottom of the band and so on. And the idea here is without really having energy dependent orbitals or without making your basis set any bigger than before, you make a contraction of these guys, so you get these NM0s, which are, it's like polynomial approximation, where you take the phis at some energies and a mesh, and then you multiply it by some Lagrangian matrix, and then you see that. But that's another. So, thank you.
This program is largely involved with dealing with systems which have some sense, some local orbital with on-site correlations that have to be dealt with. And it would be ideal, I don't know if it's possible, it would be ideal that if there could be some agreed upon or even unique definition of what the local orbital is that's, that's
yes.
The problem is centered on.
Right.
You generate local orbitals, you generate folded down bands and so forth, but it all seems to be very representation dependent, depending on sphere radii and Hankel functions and so forth. Can you express some of this in more general language so that?
To me, this is very general. I just have the phase shifts. No, yeah. I believe it might not sound like that to you that I have very few knobs. I mean, my potentials are just characterized by phase shift and nothing else. But it is clear if you have a big basis set, you, of course, can choose the axis in your Hilbert space the way you like. These guys, the way I constructed them, weren't even orthogonal. You can make them only the silicon thing in the end was orthogonal. The other ones are not orthogonal. They were simply constructed, what should I say, from chemical intuition. I think it's a nice formalism with few parameters, but the knobs you have are these alphas, only the alphas. Well, you can put the energy mesh, but I mean, we agree on which energy range to span. Then the things are only these alphas. And then the question is how many orbitals, which are the passive and which are the active. In the afternoon, I think I'll get to it. Let's take the carbon oxide. You can, of course, take all the orbitals. So you can make a three-band model or one-band model. So here's a choice how many orbitals you want to carry to how many degrees of freedom should you have. But let's agree on that also. And let's say, okay, for carbon oxides, I'm just going to keep one, the so-called carbon x squared minus y squared. How much freedom do I now have in choosing that one? And I had it. Okay, I think this is the picture. Okay, now this is getting back to the elementary. So it's just, I'm sorry. This is, see it? This is just this mercury, one-layer mercury compound. And if I only have one active channel, namely the copper x squared minus y squared, what degrees of freedom? I have the radius. I can choose this radius of the copper. But the radius is only, what is it doing? This is where I have the kink. And, bah, not this picture. That is simply saying, where, at what radius do I want x squared minus y squared? Okay, so let me see. Okay, that's length of copper. It's the same kind. So let me look at some kink partial wave at some energy here. See, yeah. So here's copper. And the only even it's not orthogonal at the moment, but I only have this, so not orthogonal means if I had the orbital here and I translate it over to the other copper side, it may not be orthogonal, but I have constructed it to be localized. So what the knob I have is I'm having one radius, named the radius in the copper x squared minus y squared channel. And that radius I can adjust, and I'll tell you what happens when I adjust it. What is the radius doing? It is saying that if I project onto that sphere here, I should have pure x squared minus y squared character. And if I project onto x squared, this is the next copper side, and the next copper side of the next. And if I go on this copper side, the x squared minus y squared character should vanish. And here it should vanish. So I have one radius with this. And you can see, now what is going to happen? As long as this radius stays inside this node between the copper and the oxygen, not much is going to happen. But if I choose that radius so big that it extends into many other atoms, yes, then things might happen.
So that kind of thing, given just block functions, which we can probably all agree on for a given single-party Hamiltonian, one can use the Vanier prescription.
Sorry, yeah.
Project
I'll get to that this afternoon. That, yes.
Okay.
Yeah. Yeah. I agree. One. No. But my answer to it, without going to the details, which I think we would this afternoon, maybe. My answer to this is a local orbital. It is not the band. Well, let's assume that the band was not overlapping with other band. Let's assume this had been an isolated band. Then you could say, well, this is one orbital. It is not a Vanier function because, as I said, it is not constructed to be orthogonal if you translate it. Now, you can orthogonalize it. Symmetric orthogonalization is what you do, Levine. And then you can ask whether these orthogonalized orbitals, I'll show you pictures this afternoon, what it looks like. Now, can I turn the phases, the Vanier phases, in such a way that it gets better or worse, or what can I do? And my result is I cannot do anything better than what I having. It is not a proof, but it is a heuristic argument. And the reason is that you see all this phase business. This is just one band, so you just have the phases. So all that you can, I'm getting the details to it. But anyhow, the phases are needed in the plane wave and other basis sets where your basis functions are complex. But what are you doing? You're choosing the phase by looking at your plane wave type thing at one side and at the copper x squared minus y squared channel. And then you keep that phase as you go from one k point to the next, you keep that phase, that thing real. Because that's the way, because then you're always in your superposition of the Gruen, so you're only going to keep this copper x squared minus y squared character the same. So that's going to be 1 plus 1 plus 1 plus 1. Whereas all the other stuff on the other side, that's going to fluctuate with the phases up and down, and it's going to cancel out in the end. So for people using real, not complex, real localized orbitals, this whole construction, in my opinion, doesn't buy you very much. You can't do very much better. And I think it's much more important than to discuss the issue, should you now use an orthogonal set or a non-orthogonal set, or what is the difference, and blah, blah. And the same comes then if you have multi-band cases and you don't need all the bands, if you want more orbitals than you have bands, then of course it's a wide thing that you can do because of these extra bands, which you're not, you have to decide on how to do that. But I don't think So my conclusion of this is, well, on this object is pretty, we will agree on that one. Let's say that. Apart from the thing that it overlaps this or that and some other.
I think it's still a question being decided whether orthogonal functions.
Yeah, that's
are
another.
Or
right. That I com- and that we should discuss, and I don't know. And all I'm saying is, I told you, I mean, these guys are constructed to be a solution in a particular energy window. And this can be very selective, as I can see, in a particular energy window. And they are chosen not to be orthogonal in the first place, but so that but in terms of these confining potentials which you put in the other. And that's what you're allowed to do to get this.
I think we will discuss this.
Just a question. So when you orthogonalize these things, how much of the copper character gets out to the other spheres?
I'll show you this afternoon.
Do you have a copy?
Yeah, I have pictures. Very little. I mean, the overlap matrix of this guy, as well, I have the math also. You put it over here. I mean, the overlap matrix is whatever, few percent. Yeah, if the diagonal is 1, then it's a few percent when you stick it over to the nearest neighbor.
Are you saying that once you orthogonalize, that then this function is the maximally
specialized yeah. value? Yeah. I couldn't imagine, but you see, I haven't calculated Vanderbilt's norm of R squared or the fluctuation. I haven't done that. But I don't see any reason that I could ask, you know, is that definition of minimizing R squared now the better one, or should rather maximize U, or what knows should you do? But looking at it in a broad sense, I can't see, and I'll give you the example of how I could localize it better. But I'd say this is not, to people coming from our camp, this is not an imminent question. For those who have a big plane wave, it is an imminent thing. You must do something like that. But if you start out from real localizing, you can easily see you can't do much. Also, as I see this Vanier function, what can you do with it? You see, you have to keep this, say, copper x squared minus y squared. And all you can do is to take it from the central side, put it out in the tails, more and more. But you see, my thing was constructed to have nothing in the tails. That was my condition. So, you know, that's why I said they can have no x squared minus y squared character here. So I don't know what you can do better. But I agree, you may, as a mathematician, not like it, but a chemist might better like it.
Okay, so let's continue this question.